Hey everybody, this is Bob Andelman from Mr. Media. First of all, I want to thank you for years of support listening to this show. We're starting our sixth year, it's hard to believe, our sixth year as 2012 starts and heading towards our 1,000th online podcast, audio and video. It's pretty amazing, frankly. I remember starting it several years ago thinking this will never last. And podcasts, that's as stupid a word as blogging. But here we are, starting our sixth year and heading up to 1,000 interviews. And I want to thank everybody for listening and supporting the show. I also want to tell you that, you know, one of the things that's been very helpful for this show is Stitcher Radio. Yes, this is sort of a commercial. Now, there are millions of smartphone apps in the world, but I only use one several times a day, Stitcher Radio. I build my own radio station to listen to broadcast and online shows when I want and in the order I want. CNN News Update, Onion Radio News, WTF with Mark Maron, MSNBC's Morning Joe, Studio 60, the TechCrunch headlines, and, of course, Mr. Media. It's free. It works on iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, Palm Pre, and much more. And you can get it for free for yourself. Try it out. I guarantee you're going to love it. Stitcher.com/MRMedia. That's Stitcher.com/MrMedia. You're going to love it. And thanks again for supporting the show. Now let's get to the good stuff. Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to legendary cartoonist Bill Griffith, the man who gave the world Zippy the Pinhead. Stick around. Frivolity is a stern taskmaster. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of polka dot wearing pinheads and upright horny toads in the Nuna Media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. You know what I really want to know from cartoonist Bill Griffith? It's this. Does he collect a royalty every time the housekeeper on Two and a Half Men, Berta, calls John Cryer's character, Alan Harper, Zippy? Because with repeats, he should really be a rich man by now. Now, nothing telegraphs an opinion of someone's intellect more rapidly than calling him or her a pinhead. And no one has done more to expand the use of the term pinhead in our society than daily cartoonist Bill Griffith, creator of the long-running Zippy the Pinhead comic strip. Zippy is an American icon, a hero, if you will, a mouthpiece alternatively for the social and political views of his creator, or just a place to drop a twisted joke or punchline. But for those who know Zippy the Pinhead only as a syndicated daily comic in newspapers around the world, you might be surprised to learn that the character has a rich history, starting in the underground comics world of the 1970s. And he was actually a second banana to creator Griffith's first character, Mr. Toad. Now, all sorts of pinhead history can be found in Griffith's introduction to his new collection, Lost and Found, Comics, 1969 to 2003. It's a 364-page treasury, and I mean treasury, of some of the cartoonist's earliest work, including Zippy and pre-Zippy, such as Young Lust, Tales of Toad, Thrilling Murder, and more. Now, this is my second conversation with Bill Griffith. The first was back in 1997, when Mr. Media was a syndicated weekly newspaper column, and you can find that on MrMedia.com. Bill Griffith, welcome back to Mr. Media.
Nice to be back, Bob.
Good to have you. Good to see you this time. This is great.
Yeah, it's a whole new world.
Now, seriously, how do you feel when you hear Zippy references, if in fact you do pick up on them, in pop culture such as Two and a Half Men?
You know, that's actually a new one to me.
Really?
I'm not a Two and a Half Men. I mean, I flip by it, but I don't linger too long. So I guess I wasn't lingering at the moment when Zippy was mentioned. Zippy was mentioned on Seinfeld. And that's repeated constantly. It's one of the episodes where Elaine's boyfriend has a mountain climbing accident, and she's worried that he might look like Zippy the Pinhead. That whenever that airs, I get phone calls and emails. But I guess my crossover audience with Two and a Half Men maybe is not quite the same as with Seinfeld.
Oh, maybe.
But yeah, you know, once in a while, whenever I hear the word pinhead and you know, David Letterman or something, I realize, you know, I dropped it in there. You know, it's due to me. I know that, but
point of pride.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it culminated actually this whole thing with Bartlett's familiar quotations some years ago, including "Are we having fun yet?" Crediting it to me. My mother was still alive at that time, and that was the high point in her life. Definitely, she was very proud of me at that time.
Really, I mean, I can certainly understand that. Nothing I've ever said will wind up in a book of quotations. I can assure you of that.
Yeah, I was squeezed between Joni Mitchell and I think Darth Vader, something like that. It was a nice company I was in with.
Talk about the height of pop culture.
Well,
I got to tell you, you'll have to check out an episode or two of Two and a Half Men.
I bet I can just, you know, Google that and see that exact, you know, 3 seconds without any problem. But I will do that.
Well, and just so you know, it recurs. They use it.
Really?
The housekeeper calls this character Alan Harper, and this is the guy who played Charlie Sheen's brother. And she always calls him Zippy. Now, I had a moment where I thought, Zippy the chimp? No, Zippy the pinhead is clearly the reference.
Well, now I am getting a little concerned. I might have to notify my battery of high-powered attorneys.
I suspect there are some Zippy the Pinhead fans on that show.
You know, Are We Having Fun Yet, as everybody knows, is used constantly without any credit to me. And I actually asked a lawyer a long time ago, what could be done, if anything, and he said, unfortunately, unless you have invented the words, if this is a sentence that could be said by anyone, you know, in normal conversation, you can't own it. He said Joan Rivers was trying to prevent anyone from doing "Can We Talk?" And if she was successful, I could you know, go on her coattails. But as far as I know, that never happened. I just gave it to the culture.
Does Crumb have any piece of "Keep on Truckin'"? You know, we see that all the time. No, same thing. Huh?
Well, yes, only in the sense that the image with his drawing, mm-hmm. and same with me, Zippy himself saying, "Are we having fun yet?" I do own that, but I can't own the words separately from Zippy's image. Hmm.
I hadn't actually thought to ask you about this, but has Zippy been successful in licensing, or do you even go that route?
I mean, I've had all kinds of things, calendars and T-shirts and hats and buttons over the years. And now, with the wonder of the Internet, I've actually consolidated it all in one place, and I get all the profits from it now instead of having to share it with somebody else. So there's a company called Zazzle, Zazzle.com. And if you go there, you'll find hundreds of Zippy merchandising items, all of which I've made.
I guess you might as well tell us, how do we spell Zazzle?
Zazzle.com / Zippy. Then you'll get to that site.
And there is the first of many free plugs to be done.
Yes.
We'll be happy to send people there if possible. I was going to ask you about your early days as an underground comics guy. But I want to ask you, since we're talking about this, does licensing a character, does that run counter to anything that you believed in as a young guy back in San Francisco, in California?
No, because, you know, you have to remember, as ubiquitous and as long living as Zippy has been, you're not talking to Charles Schulz here. The merchandising that's been done, you know, would fit into a thimble of Peanuts merchandising. So I've never had the crisis of conscience that might happen if, you know, if some huge company came and said, we want to, turn Zippy into, a brand name and microwave ovens or whatever. Yeah, that never happened. The merchandising that's been done ever since the beginning has always been sort of homegrown. My publishers in the past, my Underground Comics publishers, used to handle all the Zippy T-shirts and stuff. But we're talking thousands, not millions, in both volume and dollars. So
you're setting out the gauntlet. Challenge my confidence.
I like all the merchandising because I control it all. I make it all. So whenever you see a Zippy T-shirt or a Zippy mug or any of that, it's all stuff I've designed.
Well, so tell us about this new collection. I imagine, as I think I said in the introduction, that there is a world of daily newspaper fans who, A, don't know how far back the character goes, and B, might be a little shocked at some of the graphic content that he was associated with in the early days.
Yeah, I asked my publisher, Fantagraphics, if I should put adults only on the cover, and they said, no, we don't do that anymore. People just assume it's underground, and so it's adults. But I did slip in on the cover, where did I put that? I don't know if you can see it, but right there on the cover, Zippy is saying, I mean, the cover is saying adult material. I'm sure there will be those who will be shocked. I made sure on the Zippy website where people can buy the book autographed, I made sure to say adults only. Mm-hmm. And I've never done that in any Zippy book since I started syndicating stuff. So there will be the. I've yet to get an email, though, from anybody that's upset. Of course, it's only been out a few weeks, so I'm sure somebody will be offended, which would be nice after all these years to still offend somebody. But yeah, the average Zippy reader who only knows Zippy as a daily strip in a big city newspaper or on a big city newspaper website or through the Zippy website or King Features website will be a little taken aback. I think not only to see that I used to do adult material, but that Zippy himself was a little more adult material-ish in the early days.
Quite a bit. I mean, I like to think I've been familiar with the character for a long time. I used to, when it was in the Alternative Weekly, I guess it was a daily at that point when I picked it up in Tampa Bay Weekly back in 1988, a long time ago, when we ran it. And I remember thinking, I think of it as an adult character in a kid's world, kind of.
Well, when I started doing the daily for King Features in 1986, I did say, you know, I'm not going to use four-letter words, obviously, and I'm not going to do anything graphically sexual, but you probably will be tempted to edit me here and there, and I'm not going to make a deal with you if you do that. And they said, fine. They just said, of course, it's up to newspapers. Sometimes a newspaper will not run a Zippy strip, but not because of, you know, graphic sexual stuff, but because of, you know, either libelous or stuff. I mean, I bring in the real world a lot into my Zippy strip, and usually for satirical purposes, and it's perfectly legal, First Amendment rights being what they are, but newspapers do get skitterish occasionally.
And there are, I know people find this shocking, but there are newspapers that are to the left and right of center, and they have strong beliefs in one way or another, and sometimes, amazingly, comic strips cross those beliefs.
Exactly, and not only when you say newspapers, what you're really talking about are people, editors, and you can have a right-leaning newspaper with a left-leaning managing editor who put Zippy in, and the right-leaning editor gets upset one day. I remember when I first started Zippy, the first year it ran, it was only in the San Francisco Examiner from 85 to 86, and that was because Will Hearst III, the heir to the Hearst fortune, had taken over the paper and asked me to do Zippy, much to the dislike of his uncle, William Randolph Hearst II. And it ran on the second page of the news section for a year, and I found out later that every day the uncle would call King Features and demand that they kill the strip every day.
Wow.
They finally kicked it off the second page and put it in the comics section. That was their one move. But luckily, had he done that, who knows? I probably would have never done a daily for King Features because it would have died right there. But Will kept it in.
Good for him. And then has it been less controversial in recent years, either because people have a better sense of what they're getting and what they're getting into, or, you know, is there some mellowing on the creator's part?
Well, I do get a lot less. I mean, the kind of negative mail I get is not, and it's not outraged at my satirical jabs. It's usually that they don't get Zippy and they get angry. And when someone gets angry at a comic strip, they figure it's the cartoonist's fault. not theirs. It's a very funny phenomenon. When someone is confronted with a cubist painting by Picasso and they don't get it, they feel diminished. They feel that it's their fault. They don't really talk about it. They're slightly ashamed. When they don't get a comic strip, they think it's the cartoonist's fault because everybody should get a comic strip. It's pop culture. It's just a comic strip. Where's the punchline? And, of course, all around me are strips that deliver fairly conventional punchlines. I'm sandwiched between the Family Circus and Garfield. And there's a real head snapper right there when you're going from those two to my strip and then back to Beetle Bailey. So I get letters from people who, that's a bit of a problem for them.
Jeff Kane was on that's who I was trying to think of earlier. Jeff Kane has been on the show in the last couple of months. And, the reality is, Jeffy's a little subversive,
When Bill Keane died recently, I was asked to write a little appreciation for Fantagraphics and for a few other places, and I did mention that I always felt that The Family Circus was the other surreal comic strip on the comics page, and it made me feel sort of comfortable.
You and Stephen Pastis.
Yeah, right.
So I want to come back. I want to come back because this book, which we're talking about primarily, is about your early years. How did you get started in cartooning?
Well, I actually delineate that in my introduction to the book. I was a fine artist, so-called. I was painting. I had gone to art school for a couple of years at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. This is the early 60s to the mid-60s. And I struggled with, day jobs to try to break into the art world in New York. I think I had one show of drawings at one point. But in about 1967, early 68, I picked up the first Zap comic, which, of course, did the same thing to me it did to most people. It blew the top of my head off. And I thought my comics were getting kind of cartoony at that point, probably pop art influenced. And I thought, this guy is inside my head. He's doing what I should be doing. And a friend of mine encouraged me and gave me an idea for a strip. I drew it. I took it down to Screw, which was in its literally first three or four issues. It's a sex tabloid. At that point, Screw was more of an underground newspaper, even though it had a lot of sexual content. Anyway, I brought it down and handed it to the editor, and he said, "You drew everything to the right proportion. You're the first guy that did that." And he printed it. I had measured the size of a half page of the tabloid size of Screw, and I had done it to the right size. I was the first one that actually drew it into the right proportions. He then became later the editor of the New York Times Book Review, Steve Heller, also a very well-known just graphic designer in general. But anyway, that was it. I went from being a painter to being a cartoonist in 2 weeks. I put down the brushes as soon as my first scribblings appeared in print, and never turned back.
Wow, it was a great story. I remember thinking, to be at Screw early on before it had all this baggage that it accumulated later.
Yeah, this was Screw without that baggage. This was Al Goldstein had not yet, completely turned it into some vanity publication for himself. It was, I think it literally was issue number 5. And as I said, it was, everybody looked on it as an underground paper. And the fact that it was called Screw, I actually thought Screw meant like screw you, the establishment.
Right.
That's, who knows? That's,
it took me a long time to figure out what Queen meant in the band Queen. I think I was at least 30 before I finally got it. You just take them at face value. You don't realize you have to think about them for a minute.
Well, it's good to be a little naive. That way you remain open.
hopefully. What I wondered is, because you started there, I mean, of all places to start, and then you worked your way into Underground Press and Young Lust, things like that. Did you, over the years, did you have friends and family who maybe you were a little hesitant to give them too many details about what you were doing, or were you always pretty open about it?
I definitely kept it from my father. He would not have been happy. My mother was always very encouraging of whatever I did, so she was happy. In later years, I also put this in my introduction to the Lost and Found book. She actually got a Zippy tattoo on her left rear shoulder. So that goes shows you how far my mother accepted me.
What did she have on the right shoulder?
Huh?
Sorry.
Right shoulder?
Yeah, maybe a Woodstock or...
No, that was her only tattoo. When she came to me and said she wanted to do it, which I'm glad she did, I acted like I was the parent. I said, "You want to do what?" And once I realized she was serious, my mother was in her 70s at this time, I said, "Okay, if you're going to have a Zippy tattoo, it better be a good Zippy tattoo." So I did the drawing. I said, "Hand this to the tattooist. Make sure they follow it religiously. I want this to look right. I want the colors to all be right." And it was a beautiful Zippy tattoo. My father was a career Army officer. He was a very smart guy. He had a great sense of humor, but very rigid. And his expectations of me were that I would become some sort of an electrical engineer, I guess. I don't know. He had some dream of who I would be. But he died very early on in my comics career. But just before he died, he wrote me a letter saying, when I was living in San Francisco and he was on Long Island, saying he saw Young West number one for sale somewhere in New York, and he saw my name, and he just wanted to let me know that he was very impressed that it was distributed that widely, that he could see it. Lucky for me and for him, he did not pick it up and open it up. That would have been the end of the little reconciliation he was trying for right there. But he said he was proud of me because I was making a living out of doing this weird stuff. So
I was thinking about that because, obviously we have the book to look and see all the material collected. But, I mean, I was, in the early 70s, I was old enough because they didn't ID you at comic shops and head shops to buy, underground comics. But I've thought about myself now. I mean, I'm very careful. I coach girls soccer, middle school girls soccer, and I'm very careful about the kind of things. I have no problem with, language or anything, but I'm not going to have a stripper on the show and have her do her act, I got to thinking, someone who's drawing and writing Young Lust comics in the early 70s, did you have to be a little careful? And obviously, with your own father, you wanted to be careful. And are you protecting yourself or are you protecting him in that situation?
That's a tough question. Probably myself. If I wanted to be totally honest, I would say I was protecting him, but I would probably be protecting myself from his displeasure. Because as much as your father may be very different from you, you always want to, you want his approval, right? He gave it to me in a kind of offhanded way, kind of an indirect way, but I took whatever I could get. But my other family members just weren't aware of it at the time. I remember asking Crumb, the same question you just asked me, just one day out of curiosity, do your mother and father know about what you do? Because it's pretty raunchy stuff. And he said they haven't got a clue. I said, do you ever feel like you want to show it to them? He said, are you kidding? His wife, cartoonist Aileen Kaminsky, mm-hmm. used her mother for years as a character in her comics and was constantly dreading the day her mother might find a copy and see it. She never did. And to this day, I think now that Robert is so wealthy and famous, she excuses whatever sacrifice Aileen had to make along the way. But in the underground days, people didn't talk about their families or their nieces or nephews looking at their comics. It just wasn't.
Well, plus, I mean, the odds of your mother walking into a head shop, which is pretty much the only place you could get those comics,
right,
pretty thin, at least. And then if your mother did wander into a head shop and see something like that, the likelihood of her complaining about you being in there, having you work in there, was probably pretty thin.
Yeah, I mean, you have to remember, underground comics were underground. The word underground at this point is no such thing. You can't be underground. Mm. The internet has destroyed that completely. But in 1970, 71, there was a counterculture. It was really a separate culture, and there was a separate world in which you saw stuff you would not see in the regular straight world. And those two did not intersect. They were very separated from each other. And so to that degree, what I was doing all during the 70s, it barely would cross my mind that anybody that might be offended would see it. I didn't care if they did. And if a family member saw it, it would just be unheard of. You know, how would they ever get to it?
Now, in your early days, you traveled in some very elite, talented company, Art Spiegelman, S. Clay Wilson, Crumb, Aileen Kaminsky, as you mentioned, Gilbert Shelton. Do you think back fondly on those days? I imagine you must.
Of course. when I first arrived in San Francisco in 1970, I was part of a wave of cartoonists all flocking towards San Francisco, mostly because Robert Crumb had started Zap Comics there 2 years before, 2.5 years before. And the New York underground scene where I got my start was basically falling apart. It never really went anywhere. Whereas in San Francisco, there was this thriving publishing industry where actual comic books were being made, not just people contributing to weekly newspapers. So that's where I wanted to be. And when I got there, I think within the same few months, Art Spiegelman arrived, Justin Green arrived, Jay Kinney, Willie Murphy, of course, Crumb was already there. S. Clay Wilson was there. Gilbert Shelton was already there. And we would hang out regularly together. And we'd have, you know, parties whenever a comic was published. And we were like a little art movement.
And was it easier to get into the business at that time? I think you talk a little bit about how you basically showed up with your art. And
yeah, well, the easiest way to get into publishing in those days was through underground or alternative weekly newspapers. A little more difficult for comic books because the publishers, even though they were all kind of in the same boat with us, culturally and age-wise and everything else-wise, they did have to make a buck out of it. And they had to, you know, the book had to sell. The comic book had to at least do okay. So they had to make some sort of a commercial judgment. Whereas with an underground paper, you're just part of, you know, you're just a half page in a 40-page tabloid. You don't have to carry the commercial weight of the paper. So it was much easier to get into comics through newspapers. But even comic books were pretty open, because the audience was craved stuff. You know, comics didn't come out as regularly as they wanted. So whenever a comic came out, the audience would just grab it, and as long as it was published by one of the old, you know, underground press publishers, they would just assume it's more great underground comics. And they didn't discriminate very much. That only lasted a few years, but at that time you could sell like 20,000 of pretty much anything. Today that isn't even true. That's an amazing number amazing number of comics that would sell.
I think Dennis Kitchen, who's Kitchen Sink Press, himself quite an underground publisher and cartoonist, I think he told me at one point that typically when he published a title, they would do a first run of 10,000 copies. And he said when they finished that 10,000, they'd go back and print more of the same copy. But he said that the incredible thing was that the pass-around rate on distribution on those comics was phenomenal because you know, there were a lot of there were hippie communes, and there were flop houses, but what's the word I'm looking for? People would be living together. There'd be a lot of people in one room, and someone would buy it, and it would get read by 10 or 20 people, and the demand and the word would spread like crazy.
Yeah, you know, everybody was like I said, there was a real counterculture, and that was the audience in those days, and comics were 50 cents, which even then was cheap, although, you know, straight comics like Marvel Comics were 12 cents. So, I mean, there was a difference, but, and, you know, you would go to somebody's apartment, and there'd be like six people living there, and there'd be like seven or eight underground comics in the bathroom. And people would come and go, and yeah, they had a, I don't know what it was, probably 20 or 30 or 40 people would read each comic during a given period of time. So we had this large audience. Like I say, it didn't last forever. That was kind of all part of the general wackiness of the counterculture. And then by about 1974, partly with the Supreme Court decision on defining what pornography was, that it was up to community standards, underground comics took a big hit at that point. But it also coincided with the sort of initial glory days being over anyway. But they kept going. I mean, underground comics, the kind that I did in the early 70s, I would say probably kept going until about, I'd say about 1980.
Would you say, I was thinking about, I mentioned some of the people that you socialized with and got to know out in the San Francisco scene at the time. Was it a very politicized group? Was it just a social group? You know, if you got together with some of these people, would you wind up having political arguments or just talk about art? Well, you know, I'll never have the opportunity to be a fly on the wall in that setting. I'm just kind of wondering, can you kind of paint the scene for us, what that was like?
Well, you have to remember there were three publishers and out there in San Francisco at that time. The biggest one was the Print Mint in Berkeley. The Print Mint came out of the political turmoil of the grape strikes and the the leader of the farm growers, the farm migrant, Cesar Chavez. The Print Mint grew out of that world, and they were doing posters and things like that in support of them and not expecting to make much money out of it. Then Crumb, having done his early zaps with kind of real fly-by-night people, he thought he would try to interest a larger publisher and get them out to a wider audience, and he eventually went to the Print Mint. But the Print Mint still had that kind of political feel to it. And then there was Last Gasp, whose name was meant to imply this is our last gasp, ecologically speaking. So they were very much into both women's rights and the ecology, and they published the first women's comics. They turned down Young Lust because they thought it just wasn't political. It didn't toe the line. And then Rip Off Press, Gilbert Shelton, the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers, they were all guys from Texas. They were all from Austin. They were real Texas hippies, and they were just doing stuff about getting stoned and having a good time, basically. They were kind of like, when you went to Rip Off Press, it was like a big party, all day long. And so each one had a different personality. But when we got together as cartoonists, I don't remember much political talk, not really. We basically thought of ourselves as artists and entertainers, and just, especially when I met Art Spiegelman, then the talk became very much about comics as an art. And that was always my orientation, although I started out kind of ignoring my art background, but within a couple of years, that began to, I didn't get into comics through being a fan of comics the way most cartoonists do. My fan days probably ended when I was about 12, and then I ignored comics from that time to the point I picked up a pen and did my first strips. So I was a big fan of Mad as a kid. I read Uncle Scrooge. I was not into superheroes at all. I didn't care anything about them. And when I met other cartoonists, I realized I was not very typical, that they all had a deep background as fans of comics. And I thought of it more as an expression, a way to express yourself creatively, whatever you wanted to do. And Art Spiegelman and I kind of forged that through doing our own comics. We did Short Order, then we eventually did Arcade. And we thought of comics as kind of what it really was. It was an art movement.
Were you, did your view of art change when he did Mouse? Did you look at that and go, wow, that's, who is that guy? I thought I knew that guy, but that's quite different.
You know, it's funny. I didn't see, there's my cat. Get down, you. I didn't see the significance of Mouse. You know, it first appeared in a comic book called Funny Aminals, which I contributed to, that was somewhere in the mid-70s. And it was very short. It was about 4 pages. It was the prototype for the Mouse that came out later from in the 80s, the graphic novel. And I always knew art, you know, was tortured by his past and by his suicide of his mother, and I knew all that stuff. And I wasn't surprised when he did it. I was there when he was doing it. I remember how hard it was for him to do that strip, and I had no idea it would you know, percolate and come out, you know, 10 years later in the form it did. I actually was more impressed, and he also was more impressed with the autobiographical work of Justin Green, who did a comic around that time called Binky Brown Meets the Holy Virgin Mary. And that was his story of his childhood being tortured by nuns in the Catholic Church. And it, I remember that was a huge deal when that came out. Everybody was blown away completely, including Art. Art to this day gives Justin credit for inspiring Mouse. So, yeah, I mean, of course, Mouse, when I saw the first thing, yes, I was very impressed. But as I said, it was the seed for what was to come later. Then, of course, when I saw the graphic novel in 86. I mean, I was completely blown away how great that was.
And then one more question about that group. We've seen in the last 10 years, we've seen Robert Crumb become such a cultural landmark that, I mean, he's been in 2 movies. He was in American Splendor with Harvey, and then, of course, the movie itself, Crumb. Do you recognize the guy in those films? Is this guy that you basically sort of came up with, or is that like a whole other person?
Not the American Splendor Crumb, the actor who played Robert. I mean, I liked that movie a lot, so I'm not putting down the movie. It's a great movie. But that wasn't Crumb, and that was not even a caricature of Crumb. I don't know where that came from. Crumb in the movie Crumb in the documentary by Terry Zwigoff, of course, that's really Robert. That's him. Though that movie, I think, got out of hand and became a movie about Robert's family and how dysfunctional and wacky they were. And that was a decision made by the producer. Terry wanted to make it a lot more about Crumb the artist. And once, I forget her name, the woman that produced it, once she saw the footage, she said, this is about his family. This is what we have. And she made it, I thought it had a sort of Oprah Winfrey quality in a way. You know, a little bit too much of a freak show. Anyway, Robert's reaction to the movie was to commit symbolic suicide by tossing his fedora off a cliff, and he grew a beard, which he has to this day. The beard that you see pictures of Robert these days, that beard is because of that movie. He didn't want to be recognized anymore.
Wow. Well,
but yeah, I mean, the Robert I know is the same guy that I've known the whole time. He's very steady, same person. His fame, the only thing that's affected him, the only way his fame has affected him is given him the freedom to, you know, buy his daughter a house. I mean, he's the same person, completely untouched in any way.
Well, speaking of movies and weirdness, coming back to Lost and Found, which is why we're here, of course. The comics speak for themselves. I keep focusing on the introduction because I thought it was fascinating to finally get some insight into the history, your history, and the characters' histories and the comics' history. It was very interesting to read about the history of Zippy and the film industry.
Oh, yes.
You must have wanted to, like, blow your brains out a few times after dealing with those people out there.
Well, as I think I might have said in the introduction, after 20-some-odd years of trying to make a Zippy movie and a TV show, I realized what I'd really been doing is gathering anecdotes for cocktail parties. And in that way, I'm grateful for the whole thing. And no, there were moments when things fell apart where I would, you know, have a bad day. But no more than that, because it was so unlikely that anything ever would happen. The few times when we got to a point where I thought something really was going to happen were the only times I got, emotionally involved and upset. But the rest of the time I was just gathering material. You know, if I got a phone call, there's several people who took options on Zippy who would then go try to get meetings in Hollywood. And if I got a phone call, I said, so-and-so wants us to come down. They're sending, plane fare and taking care of the hotel. I would say, absolutely, I'm there. Because I knew I would have a good time. I would have an interesting experience. Now, we would, Disney ones asked for a meeting because they had passed on Pee-wee Herman. This was before Paul Rubens, got caught in the porno theater.
Right.
This was between Pee Wee Herman movie number one and maybe number two. And Disney had apparently been pitched for the first Pee Wee, and they turned it down. So when they heard about Zippy, they thought, oh, Zippy, this is like, we shouldn't, not make that mistake again.
Zippy, this might Pee-wee, be the next, same thing.
The next Pee Wee, Zippy, Pee Wee, it sounds similar, cartoony looking. And so they actually asked for a meeting, so we walked into the meeting. And there was the script on the table, and there were the guys with suits behind the desk, and I was expecting to talk about the script, which, of course, was very naive of me at any time. They don't talk about the script. They think of the script as, a sketch to be very malleable, to be changed at the whim of whatever. So they said, no, the script is great. We love the script. We just have one problem with Zippy. I was ready for something big, whatever. He talks in surrealistic sentences. They said, the stubble. I said, the stubble? And I said, yes. Well, we're trying to picture a Zippy big head walk-around figure in Disneyland and Disney World. Those big heads that Mickey and Minnie heads. And how would the stubble look that big? And would it stick out like little, cylinders? Would it pop out of his face? And if it did, wouldn't that frighten small children? And I didn't know what to say. I said, and this was in the 80s. I said, Miami Vice, Don Johnson's got stubble. Hey, stubble's in. Stubble's happening. And 5 minutes later, we were in the elevator. That was it. See, now, this was a great example. If I had said at that point, oh, well, of course, Zippy can shave. Stubble is gone. It's history. There's no stubble. Then the meeting would have progressed to the next stage, which I would have to make one more compromise, and then another one. And then we finally would have had a deal, and I'd have walked out of there with a check, and everybody would be happy. But that didn't happen. We were in the elevator, usually at the end of every meeting, and always wondering, looking at each other. I mean, the producers and the guys that had the option, we would look at each other. Why did that meeting end? What happened?
I as I was reading that and listening to you talk, I was thinking about what Will Eisner had told me years ago about all the movie people who optioned the Spirit from him over the years. And he said, I love getting the checks. Wonderful. Every time one of their checks shows up and they renew the option, I love that. What I hate is the idea that any of them ever think that they could possibly make a movie of the Spirit and that I might live long enough that I'd have to see it. And then when he saw one that ABC TV did, because they had optioned to do a TV series, and it was awful, and he said it was like cardboard. I always think back to, I think of the Frank Miller version that finally did come out a couple years ago, and how grateful I was that Will did not live to see that, because the creative arguments alone probably would have killed him.
Yeah, I was worried the whole time too, that What if we did make a movie? Would Zippy be destroyed? Would I have to stop doing my daily strip? I thought of the parallel to Crumb and Fritz the Cat. When Fritz the Cat movie was made, that was made against his wishes, because his wife had rights, and then she made a deal with Ralph Bakshi, yada yada. And when that movie came out, he hated it so much he killed Fritz the Cat. He did a strip in which Fritz the Cat gets an axe, into the top of his head and dies. And I thought that would, if that's going to be the punchline to this story, I don't want to go there. So I probably was sabotaging deals left and right. I mean, we once had another meeting where Dennis O'Brien, who was vice president of Handmade Films, which was George Harrison's film company, he came to talk to us. He actually flew from London to have a Zippy meeting, And his big thing was, he said, we do have one problem, the Moomoo. And I said, what do you mean, the polka dots? Or what the? He said, well, after all, it is a grown man wearing a dress. How would you feel if we took off the Moomoo and gave him a tank top and jeans? Meeting over, yeah. Elevator beckoned, back to the parking lot. Although I got a great strip out of that. I had Zippy waking up one morning, going to his closet and opening it up and finding, 82 exact Moomoos, all completely identical, and struggling to figure out which one to put on in the morning. So.
Now, have you ever been approached by the folks at Cartoon Network and the Underground, what's it called, Underground Swim? Is that the?
Adult Swim.
Adult Swim, yeah.
I have been, yeah. Nothing really went anywhere. But
I would have thought that would be the perfect, this, entertainment is so niche-oriented now, you can do, it would seem to be a respectful place for it.
I'm open to talking to someone like that. That might be somewhere where it would really work. I don't know. They contacted me very briefly a few years ago, and I don't think anything ever happened.
Talking about Zippy a little further, away from the movies, though, but can you look at him today and yesterday, because I'm sure you had to spend a bit of time putting together Lost and Found, and can you kind of pinpoint, I'm sorry I used that term, but can you pinpoint his development as a character?
Well, the original Zippy, and you see him in Lost and Found, in some of the early Zippy stories, was very much of a loose cannon kind of a character. He was really more based on the original Pinhead that I had first seen in the 1932 movie Freaks. And in that movie, there are several Pinheads, but they're only there in the background. They don't really have speaking parts, but you can kind of hear what they're saying. And they seem to be speaking very rapidly and very, very much in non-sequitur fashion. And that's where Zippy's initial personality came from, the Pinheads I saw in that movie. I gave him, slightly different costume. I gave him a little more wide-ranging vocabulary. But he would say literally one thing after the other with no relation between them at all. And they would come to me, and I would just write them. I would not think, they should relate in some fashion, whether it's specific or not specific, but no, I didn't censor myself. I had Zippy just yelling out non sequiturs like crazy and running around and getting into crazy situations. That went on for a few years. And I remember at one point Art Spiegelman telling me that he liked Zippy, but it was a little bit like getting stuck in an elevator with a crazy person. you're amused at first, but you're in this confined space. And the elevator is taking a while to get down to the ground floor, and you get a little edgy. And I began to think, Zippy needs to be modulated in some way. Something has to modulate him. So that's when I brought in Griffey, my alter ego character. And once Griffey and Zippy got together, it was a little bit more like, a comedy team, like Abbott and Costello or something. And Zippy's non sequiturs then began to interact with Griffey's sequitur, I would describe Griffey's more normal, rational critical way of thinking and speaking. And so they would bounce off each other. And so then Zippy's non sequitur started to actually not be nonsense, but a little more like just seeing the world from a slightly off-center point of view and seeing things through like a fractured lens, and Griffey would react, and then Zippy would say something else, and at the end of it, there would be some sort of coherence. And I think once I gave Zippy Griffey, I think I gave him a long, much longer life. And then recently, in the past 4 or 5 years, I've created this world in which Zippy lives in a town of pinheads called Dingberg. But three quarters of my strips these days take place in Dingberg, this place I invented just one day, not thinking it would go further than just a couple of strips. But I find I just find an endless amount of material in that vein.
Well, you mentioned this way that Zippy sees the world through like a fractured lens, and actually that was a neat way to transition for me. I wanted to ask you, I know that, and from reading, again, reading the book, that you once had some issues with Saturday Night Live's Coneheads characters as being influenced by Zippy, but, and here I go, I'm going to take another shot at sitcom reference, but do you ever watch 30 Rock and the character of Kenneth the Page?
I have a little bit. I'm not a regular viewer of that show, but I know who you mean.
Well, if anything, he seems to live even closer to Zippy's world than anyone else in pop culture. As a matter of fact, I think they did an episode once that was the world through Kenneth the Page's eyes, and you know, he seems to see everyone as like Muppets, and you know, it's very, very strange. And I, you know, it's another point where I thought, well, that seems to be a bit of Bill Griffith's influence on culture there to me.
Yeah, well, the one thing about the movie that I wished had happened, if some ideal version had ever been produced, was that we were going to have Zippy have these moments in the movie called Zippy Vision, where you would go from, the camera point of view would go into his head, and you'd see the world suddenly because of some trigger. Like, for instance, if Zippy was walking across the street and suddenly he would see Yosemite Sam walking towards him, then you go inside his head, and then you realize, oh, it's just Zippy's, just from Zippy's point of view, Yosemite Sam isn't really walking towards him. And then you would stay in Zippy's head for a certain amount of time, and you would completely, the movie would just go into a completely other world, but it would just happen for a minute or two, and it would happen unexpectedly throughout the film, and we tied them together with a plot, and it actually worked plot-wise. And those would have been wonderful wonderful things to see, had the movie ever been made, or had it ever been made the way I wanted it, which is sadly unlikely.
Well, thank you very much, because you've given us a lot of your time today. Just kind of curious, where do you go next? Obviously, you're continuing to do the strip. Are there more collections to be made? Are there other side projects? What are you focused on?
Well, I'm continuing to do my daily strip, so every year or two I come out with a collection of Zippy strips, and there'll be another one coming out next year. And so that goes on. I have no idea how much longer this is going to keep going. I have recently been approached to teach comics, and I'm going to be starting that next year at the School of Visual Arts in New York.
Oh, that's great.
I'll be teaching a cartooning course there. And that might open up a whole different realm for me. That should be fun.
Spiegelman is taught there, Eisner, Kurt.
Yeah. Yep. And Gary Panter.
Yep. Yeah. Very distinguished line of teachers there. That's great. Mm-hmm. And, okay, I'm going to ask you, actually I have one more question. It just occurred to me when you said that you don't know how much longer this could continue. I hate to ask you this, Bill, but, I mean, could Zippy continue without you? Any plan for that?
No. If Zippy, if I decide to stop Zippy, that's the end of Zippy. It's like me and, I don't know, you know, George Harriman and Charles Schultz, to put myself in august company. Nobody else can carry that on. I don't think anybody else would want to carry it on particularly. And, you know, would I, you know, I'm getting older, you know, I start thinking about what I might do in the next 10 years. Would I still be doing my daily strip? Maybe not. I don't know. I do think I have one project I would like to do when and if I stop doing the Zippy Daily Strip, which would be called The Key to Zippy. And it would be literally a, like the key to Finnegan's Wake, you know, like the key to Dash, the books that come out that students are told they have to read to understand certain things. And I would do this pseudo serious long book, giving people a completely unnecessary explanation of exactly how to read Zippy.
Overcomplicate and
yes, right. Completely overcomplicated. Yeah, just insanely analytical and crazy. Yeah, so I'm taking notes.
I was going to say you should start dictating that book now.
Yes, I should.
You really should. That's great. Well, folks, listen, you can, of course, find Zippy the Pinhead in many daily newspapers around the United States. But also, check out cartoonist Bill Griffith's new book, Lost and Found, Comics, 1969 to 2003. It's in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Bill, have you been sucked into the world of websites and social media?
Oh, yeah. Well, as long as you're giving plugs, people can get a free daily Zippy, the one-day delay daily Zippy strip every day in their email by just going to zippythepinhead.com, and right in the middle of the homepage you'll see subscribe now.
Okay.
Just click that link and you're subscribed.
Excellent. All right. And, of course, zippythepinhead.com. You just gave that out. Bill, it was a pleasure to get to see you and talk to you in greater depth, and continued good health and good work. And thanks so much for joining us, Mr. Media, today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
For more original interviews, surf over to our main website, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. If you've enjoyed today's show, subscribe for free to Mr. Media via email, RSS, or iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Another good idea, download our new free Mr. Media mobile app in the Android market. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many parts of the Internet. Show your support of Mr. Media by supporting our sponsors, including Audible. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/radio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/radio for your free audiobook. We're also supported by thepartyauthority.us. Call DJ Ira for all your party entertainment needs nationwide at 1-800-DIAL-DJS. Or visit their website, thepartyauthority.us. If you've got an idea for a guest, a comment on today's show, or would like to advertise on Mr. Media Radio, email me directly at bob@mrmedia.com, mrmedia.com. You can also call our 24-hour listener line at 1-727-498-4711. Some messages may be used in an upcoming show. And unless you live next door to Mr. Media, there may be a toll charge. You can also follow Mr. Media on Facebook, Twitter, or our new YouTube and Vimeo video channels. Thanks so much for joining us today. I always appreciate you sharing a piece of your day with Mr. Media. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching.
Hi, this is Red Peters. And whenever I'm not rearranging my sock drawer, I listen to Bob Andelman, Mr. Media.
Hey, everybody. This is Bob Andelman from Mr. Media. First of all, I want to thank you for years of support listening to this show. We're starting our sixth year. It's hard to believe our sixth year as 2012 starts and heading towards our 1,000th online podcast, audio and video. It's pretty amazing, frankly. I remember starting it several years ago thinking, this will never last. And podcasts, that's as stupid a word as blogging. But here we are, starting our sixth year and heading up to 1,000 interviews. And I want to thank everybody for listening and supporting the show. I also want to tell you that, you know, one of the things that's been very helpful for this show is Stitcher Radio. Yes, this is sort of a commercial. Now, there are millions of smartphone apps in the world, but I only use one several times a day, Stitcher Radio. I build my own radio station to listen to broadcast and online shows when I want and in the order I want. CNN News Update, Onion Radio News, WTF with Mark Maron, MSNBC's Morning Joe, Studio 60, the TechCrunch headlines, and, of course, Mr. Media. It's free. It works on iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, Palm Pre, and much more. And you can get it for free for yourself. Try it out. I guarantee you're going to love it. Stitcher.com/MRMedia. That's Stitcher.com/Mr. Media. You're going to love it. And thanks again for supporting the show.
Hi, this is Jeff Keane, or Jeffy from the Family Circus. Whenever I talk to people and I say, who's listening to Mr. Media? They say, not me. And I don't know.